10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg. Next. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm very, very happy to welcome into our studios for today's program Jerry Mast, Associate Professor of Political Science at Carthage College. And Professor Mast, of course, joins us on a fairly regular basis to talk about all matters political. And earlier in the week, a faculty colleague of ours, Dr. Yuri Maltsev, was on the program, and he referred at one point to President Trump as the gift that keeps on giving, in the sense that, I think Professor Maltsev was probably saying that in several different respects, but one of them certainly was that when you have a president like Donald Trump, chances are there is a lot to talk about. And of course, this presidency is cause for people to give a lot of thought to how they view our nation and themselves and the role of government and what it takes to be a great president and so on. And so there is a very, very intense national discussion going on at the moment, albeit people not always listening to each other from across the aisle. But anyway, I'm excited for this opportunity today to hear from Dr. Jerry Mast on his thoughts on the Donald Trump presidency thus far, and in particular, some of the challenges and controversies that he is confronting at the moment. Professor Mast, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks, Gregory. It's always good to be here.
Glad that you can be with us. So before we start tackling some very specific points of policy and practice and so on, it might make sense for us to start with kind of a more general overview. How do you view President Donald Trump and his presidency thus far?
Well, I want to be very careful in what I say. Choose my words judiciously. I think in a time of political polarization, there is this tendency to be hyperbolic, to exaggerate certain kinds of things. But I also think that there is also this tendency, maybe it's paradoxical, that when people are in the midst of some kind of historically important events, that they fail to see it, right? That things kind of gradually shift to become normal. There is a possible efforts to try to define what you see in ways that make it seem more normal than it otherwise would be. So I do want to be careful in how I characterize my sense of where the Trump administration is. But with that caveat in mind, I think what we're watching unfold in Washington over the last few months is a profoundly flawed policy vision being pushed by an incompetent president whose unfitness for the office is contributing to the emergence of scandals that threaten to undermine his administration's effectiveness and potentially bring the president down. Mm. I think that we can, from that statement, begin to explore the scandals themselves. We can examine the president's competence or unfitness, and we can examine the profound flaws in the policy vision that, if implemented, I think are going to be very detrimental to the public interest.
Why don't we start with the matter of incompetence, because that's a pretty strong charge to level at the chief executive of the land. What prompts you to frame your comments right. about the president in those kind of terms?
Right. Well, presidential scholar Paul Quirk argues that you can be an incompetent president by trying to do too much, by assuming that you are capable of tackling all things as the president. But you can also be flawed in the opposite direction, in which you just simply delegate all things to all people and are in some sense not aware of what it is that the administration is actually doing. And there's a couple things in that framework that Quirk points out that I think are apropos. No president ever is an expert in all policy, right? I mean, even scholars of politics, we tend to emphasize a few issue areas, and that's where our expertise resides. And so no president can tackle and micromanage all of the things that an administration has to be aware of. But presidents should be expert in one or two things. They should be really knowledgeable about a few policy issues. Moreover, they need to have some kind of minimal understanding of policy generally so that they can become intelligent consumers of information that's brought forward, that they can recognize false claims, that they can recognize better arguments from worse arguments, and they are competent enough to delegate appropriately to people, right? And beyond that, they also have to have a sense of process. How do decisions get made? How do policies emerge within the complex system? Where are the appropriate stakeholders for particular kinds of positions? With whom do you need to consult in the process of bringing forward a policy idea? And once a policy idea has been passed, then you have to pay attention to the process associated with putting it into action to implement it. That means paying attention, to the various stakeholders and listening to their arguments about rules and regulations and approaches, different kinds of arguments about the constitutionality of different decisions, the legality of different kinds of decisions, the consequences. All policies are very, very complicated, and they evolve lots of decision points, and presidents need to, one, avoid trying to micromanage all of those decision points, but they have to be competent enough to judge the merits of the different arguments that emerge over the course of a policy. And I think that President Trump does not know enough about the world, about the economy, about the government itself to one, judge the merits of particular kinds of arguments and their potential consequences. Now, there's, I think, a lot of criticism going on about the White House, about the executive branch in terms of the enormous amounts of leaks that are happening. I mean, this is a journalist's, dream kind of administration. There are people within the executive branch divulging all kinds of information. We've never seen this amount of information flowing. Why is that? Because the administration is filled with disloyal people? Or is it filled with people who are worried and upset and concerned about the way in which the executive branch is being managed and directed? I think the more sensible explanation is the latter. And what we some of these leaks are telling us is something about the way in which the White House operates. One, the president is very impressionable. Multiple people have said that the president is likely to believe the last thing he heard at the end of a meeting. He is very dependent upon staff to bring him information. And there was an article in the magazine Politico a little while ago that mentioned that his supporters are bringing cherry-picking information to give him, to keep his spirits up, to make him happy, that he's getting frustrated and angry. And so they're trying to give him only news that is going to boost his spirits up. And otherwise, they're afraid that he'll get angry and start tweeting unwisely, saying things about his critics that only kind of detract from the image of the president. So, I mean, those are the kinds of things. When I say the president is incompetent, he just seems to be a very poor administrator. He seems to be a very poor leader, a communicator. And a communicator, I mean, there's both ways. You need to listen very well as express yourself. I think that's why one of the reasons why the administration has, to this point, floundered. Mm.
You also mentioned something as we were talking before going on the air, that there is a role that the president plays, and I think most people would argue that it's really heart and soul of what it means to be the president, and that is to be the chief of state, that is to be the leader of all of us, and in a sense to represent all of us, even those of us even those who might even adamantly disagree with him or see the world very differently, but otherwise being the leader of this entire country. And you were, I think, talking about how that seems to be a facet of being president that
he struggled with.
Right. That does not seem to be at the top of his priorities in terms of the manner in which he's leading.
Right. Some political systems actually divide those roles up. Right. Britain has a queen. She's the chief of state. They have a prime minister. This person, she's in charge of running the government. In our system, we combine the role of chief of state and prime minister, essentially, in the form of a president. The president, as chief of state, it's a ceremonial role. It's a symbolic role. Those are important things. They are the representative of the country. They symbolize the nation. They are the nation's leader. They represent the nation, right? It is also true that presidents are the kind of administrator of implementation. They manage the government like a prime minister would. And so that involves harder decisions, partisanship, and so on and so forth. When you're chief of state, you've got to reach out. You've got to be attentive to the dignity of the office, the graciousness, right, that we expect in political leaders that are going to have widespread appeal and support. And President Trump has been very much focused on his base, pushing policies, engaging in rhetoric, accusing his predecessor of illegally surveilling him, which, you know, is – there doesn't seem to be any evidence for. And all of that kind of undercuts his capacity to function well as chief of state.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Jerry Mast, who is associate professor of political science at Carthage College. We're receiving his take on the presidency of Donald Trump. You have a rather formidable document sitting in front of you. It looks like a big, long... Is that a checklist or a timeline?
You know, it's a list of events that have happened in terms of you know, the scandals that have emerged over the firing of the FBI director Jim Comey, questions surrounding obstruction of justice, the investigation of collusion potentially alleged between the Trump campaign and Russian authorities and all of that. I mean, it's really complicated, and there's all of these kinds of moving parts to the story. And so even for someone like myself who has spent years studying government and public policy, who does consume a lot of news, it becomes confusing. And so, you know, in preparation for the interview, I just kind of wrote these events down so as to kind of get a sense of for myself, you know, where are we? Why have we gotten to where we're at?
Right. We should probably talk about the matter of Russia, because, of course, this is of paramount concern to many. And of course, there are even multiple investigations going on simultaneously. And, of course, that in and of itself kind of makes for a complicated situation. And one of the most difficult things to separate is sort of the suppositions from the things that are cut and dried, undeniable facts.
Right.
And
from things that have been alleged to be true that we
exactly.
don't know for sure.
Right.
Well, I mean, the issues who emerged, right, in our awareness last year during the campaign, Donald Trump as candidate seemed to be taking a fairly unorthodox approach to Russia and to President Vladimir Putin, seemed to say lots of good things about Mr. Putin, seemed to suggest that an administration under his direction would warm up with Russia and establish closer relations, all of which, you know, seemed kind of outside the norm of what we've seen from both Democrats and Republicans in recent years. At one point in the campaign, he seemed to call out for Russia to hack into Hillary Clinton's email server and release all these missing emails, which, you know, struck many of us at the time as an unorthodox thing for a candidate for president to say, encouraging a foreign power to engage in some espionage against his opponent. And then last fall, we began to hear reports that Russia was interested in influencing the election, that there was attempts on the part of the Russian authorities to sway the election, to influence its outcome, to undercut Secretary Clinton to the advantage of President Trump. There is a report that came out in January, a declassified report, an intelligence memo to the president from the director of the National Intelligence Council. And I think it's worth just reading a little bit of the preamble.
Sure. And is this before the inauguration? Is this the president of Obama?
This is before the inauguration. It reads, and I quote, "Russian efforts to influence the 2016 U.S. presidential election represent the most recent expression of Moscow's longstanding desire to undermine the U.S.-led liberal democratic order. But these activities demonstrated a significant escalation in directness, level of activity, and scope of effort compared to previous operations. We assess," and "we," this is the combined summary judgment of work by the National Security Agency, the FBI, and the CIA. "We assess Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered an influence campaign in 2016 aimed at the U.S. presidential election. Russia's goals were to undermine public faith in U.S. democratic processes, denigrate Secretary Clinton, and harm her electability and potential presidency. We further assess Putin and the Russian government developed a clear preference for President-elect Trump. We have high confidence in these judgments." The report continues to explain in a fairly vague way, because this is a declassified report. I mean, the classified version has much more detail. But the declassified version talks about the dissemination of misinformation and propaganda through the internet, especially through social media, paying trolls to put out rumors and false statements. Of course, there was the hacking into the DNC computer system and the theft of information there. But there was also hacking against the campaigns themselves, both at the general election and the primary level, that the intelligence communities had evidence of. There was hacking into think tanks and advocacy groups. And they also, the report mentions the intrusion, Russian intrusion into state and local election boards. So, I mean, it was a fairly pervasive effort on the part of Russia to kind of shape public opinion in the United States.
Of course, there's nothing exactly illegal about that, right?
Well, it's illegal to hack into somebody else's computer and steal their information.
Right. But I mean, as a general principle, and it's also something that America itself is.
Yeah, so all this is kind of run-of-the-mill espionage. The United States itself engages in this. And so, you know, I think all of this begs some very important, difficult questions that Americans should be thinking about in terms of our own behavior if we want to. You know, remain consistent with the golden rule.
Right.
Maybe we should re-examine some of our own intelligent practices. When it comes, though, to this question of legality or illegality, there is the question of to what extent were members of the Trump campaign involved in any of that activity, right?
And that would be the matter then of collusion.
Yeah, so this matter of collusion. And the Logan Act is a federal law that says private citizens are not are forbidden. Private citizens are forbidden from negotiating with foreign powers to undermine public policy. When in December, Michael Flynn, who became the national security advisor at the onset of the Trump administration, he apparently had a number of phone conversations with the Russian ambassador about Russia's response to the Obama administration's expulsion of 35 diplomats, which they felt were intelligence agents, from the country. And according to the conversations with Mr. Flynn, he said, you know, don't overreact to this, that the sanctions can be removed. That may be a violation of the Logan Act. Aside from that, I mean, if there is aiding and abetting the stealing of information from John Podesta, Clinton's campaign manager, or the DNC, well, then those are illegal activities.
Hmm. What would the – and maybe there's a simple answer to this and maybe there isn't. What would be the point of supporters of then-candidate Trump trying to seek out the assistance of entities from Russia to interfere in the campaign? Why not simply do it yourself? Is it that would be you have ink on your own hands? I mean, that you want this dirty stuff to be done by somebody else? I mean, it seems like that would be a really dangerous and unpredictable way to try to make something happen, to try to get that kind of assistance, foster that kind of assistance from another country.
Well, we don't know what else they were doing. Maybe they were engaged in their own efforts to do. I mean, clearly they weren't in the business of trying to make us think well of Secretary Clinton.
Right. Of course.
Right. So, I mean, there were their own activities going on in terms of trying to sway public opinion.
And in the other direction, I mean, that's part of what campaigns are all about.
Right. Well, and when last summer the CIA and the NSA intercepted communication with certain Russian officials, they became aware of the potential for interaction between the Trump campaign and the Russian authorities. When the Russians themselves mentioned Paul Manafort and Michael Flynn as really potentially useful people that they could work with in the process of trying to influence the election. So does that mean Paul Manafort and Michael Flynn actually did work with Russians? No, not necessarily. That is what the point of an investigation would be. But the Russians did mention them by name in their own internal communications. And when the CIA and the NSA picked this up, that's when they became concerned. They in classified briefings, made certain senators on the Intelligence Committee aware of that, look, there is this potential collusion happening. They let the president know, look, there's this potential problem going on. And we don't know, right, if this has actually happened. Again, that's the point of an investigation.
Sure. That what you were just mentioning almost makes it sound like if there was collusion, again, the word is if, of course,
right.
But if there was collusion, that there's every possibility that it was more the Russians' idea. They saw the potential. They
yes.
saw how much they want. They preferred
yes.
so if a President Trump to a President Hillary Clinton, and they were willing to
right. So if there was contact, it seems like it was initiated by the Russians. But it's not like Paul Manafort and Michael Flynn didn't already have connections to Russia. Paul Manafort, of course, had well established connections to the Russians directly in some instances, but mostly indirectly, working on behalf of Ukrainian politicians who were pro Russia, and was paid millions of dollars apparently for his work lobbying on their behalf in Washington, giving them advice about how to relate to the United States, how to improve their position relative to the United States. Michael Flynn was the recipient of hundreds of thousands of dollars from Russians and from $500,000 from the Turkish the government of Turkey, and he was lobbying for Turkey while he was working for the campaign. His investigation involves. The investigation of Michael Flynn involves allegations that he misled members of the Pentagon in getting his security clearance, not disclosing that he met with the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, not disclosing that he worked and received I think it was, if I remember, $60,000 from Russia Today to give a speech at a anniversary celebration of theirs in Moscow. And when you lobby for a foreign government like he did for Turkey, when you're paid to represent a foreign government, you're supposed to disclose this to the federal government. And so when somebody becomes national security advisor, it might be worth considering, right, that they have been paid to work for a foreign government. And of course, the excuse for his being fired by the Trump administration was that he lied, which he did, to Vice President Pence over his discussions with the ambassador, Kislyak.
The matter here of what exactly happened, who knew what, when did they know it, and so on, is one matter to untangle, and of course that's the point of all these investigations. But beyond that, of course, is the potential that perhaps the greatest jeopardy that President Trump faces is in the matter of obstruction of justice. Help us untie that, because of course many of the actions that President Trump has taken that his opponents objected to were nevertheless actions he was, at least to some extent, perfectly able to do, I mean, and permitted to
right.
do.
Right.
So how is it possible for permissible acts to somehow cross a line and suddenly be obstruction of justice and something that is not permitted?
Right. Well, let's walk through what actually happened, some of the kind of think of the relevant history here. On November 10th, President Obama warns Donald Trump not to hire Michael Flynn as the National Security Advisor. In January, the acting attorney general, Sally Yates, informs the White House that Flynn lied about meeting with Kislyak in December. On the 27th of January, Trump meets with Comey and asks for his loyalty. An unusual move, but that is what he did, and is rebuffed by Comey, apparently. In the middle of February, the 14th, Trump meets with Comey and asks him to drop the investigation into Flynn, and is rebuffed. The 20th of March, Comey testifies to the House Intelligence Committee that there's no evidence that Obama wiretapped Trump, as Trump claimed, but there is an active FBI investigation into possible collusion between Trump campaign and Russian figures. The first week of May, Comey requests more resources for the Trump and Russia campaign investigation from the Department of Justice. That would be Rod Rosenstein. That's according to New York Times story, and Department of Justice spokesperson does deny that. But on the 8th of May, per ABC News, Trump confides with staff, including Vice President Pence, that he's decided to fire Comey. He requests a written opinion from the Department of Justice. That would be Sessions and Rosenstein, explaining why such a decision would be justified. The next day, on the 9th of May, he fires Comey, Trump does, citing the Department of Justice memo. He states the handling of Hillary Clinton's emails by Mr. Comey and a lack of faith and trust in the Bureau in Mr. Comey as the reasons for his being fired. He doesn't let his communication staff know that he's about to fire this until like the very last minute. This is, you know, one of the reasons that prompts Sean Spicer to hide in the bushes outside of the White House, right, to avoid these uncomfortable questions from reporters who find him anyway, right? And it's only when they agree to turn off the cameras that he comes out. And when he comes out, he says, look, the impetus for the firing came from the Department of Justice. Kellyanne Conway that same night expressed the same to CNN. So the story that the Trump administration is clearly giving, right, the vice president does it the next day, is that the firing of Jim Comey came from the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice, Rod Rosenstein, on the 10th, calls the White House lawyer, McGahn, and insists that the White House correct the story. He says, look, you're saying this impetus for the decision came from us. You've got to own up to it. You're the ones who asked for this, and you had already decided you wanted to do it when you asked for it. So he insists on this, and the White House later that day corrects the story. This is according to stories published in the Wall Street Journal. The same day, they admit that Trump is the one who initiated the firing of Comey. That same day, Jason Chaffetz, Republican chair of the House Oversight Committee, requests that the Inspector General of the Department of Justice begin an investigation into the firing of Comey. Also that day, I mean, the number of events that are happening are multiple. Trump meets with Russians, the Ambassador Kislyak and the Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov in the Oval Office. This is the meeting in which he allegedly discloses top secret information about ISIS. And he allegedly says he fired Comey, who he allegedly called a nut job, and that now all this pressure that he had been facing has been lifted. On the 11th, Trump goes on NBC Nightly News, the 11th of May. He goes on NBC Nightly News with Lester Holt and admits to firing Comey over the Russia investigation, undercutting, right, the claims of the vice president and so forth, that this was about the email handling of Clinton and a lack of faith on the part of agents working in the FBI in their leader. That same day, the acting FBI director, Andrew McCabe, comes on and says Comey enjoyed widespread support amongst the agents, that there was no loss of confidence. On the 12th, Trump tweets his threats to Comey, right, that, hey, you better hope there's not tapes of our conversations when you talk to the press. The next week, on the 15th of May, the Washington Post reports that the Trump-Lavrov-Kislyak meeting involved the disclosure of top-secret information. Outcome from the White House, H.R. McMaster is the current national security advisor, to deny that happened to the press. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson does the same. The next day, President Trump tweets that he did disclose it, undercutting his national security advisor and his Secretary of State. He also asserts that he has an absolute right to it. And this goes to the argument about whether or not Trump is within his rights to fire the FBI director. It is the next day, the 17th, that Rod Rosenstein invokes his right under law to appoint a special counsel to investigate all of this. It is the case that presidents have the right to fire the people who work at the top of the agencies that they appoint, right? The FBI director is one of them. In the conversation with our colleague, Dr. Moltsev, he refers to the attorney law professor at Harvard, Alan Dershowitz, saying, there's no obstruction of justice here. The president has the right under the unitary theory is what he's of the executive is what he's basing this claim on. I think before we get into the unitary theory of the presidency, let's think a little bit about what obstruction of justice is. So this is the 18th chapter of the U.S. Code, section 1505. It says, whoever corruptly or by threats of force or by any threatening letter or communication influences, obstructs, or impedes, or endeavors to influence, obstruct, or impede the due and proper administration of the law under which any pending proceeding is being had before any department or agency of the United States, or due proper and proper exercise of the power of inquiry under which any inquiry or investigation is being had by either House or Committee of the House or Joint Committee of the Congress, right, is guilty of obstruction of justice. So the question is, does the president have the right to do what obstruction of justice says is against the law because he has the right to fire someone? Is his right, exercising his right to fire the director of the FBI, does that obviate or dismiss any obligation to adhere to the law with respect to obstruction of justice?
Which supersedes which?
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, that takes us to this unitary theory of the executive. The unitary theory of the executive is a very controversial theory about presidential power. Various kinds of arguments that relate to the unitary theory go all the way back to the beginning of the country. But it's not until the 1980s that we get really kind of thoughtful, sophisticated arguments about the unitary theory. It essentially says that the vesting clause and the take care clause of this Article 2 of the Constitution, in which the executive authorities are vested in the president, and the president shall take care to implement the laws of the country. Those two clauses are used by adherents to this unitary theory of presidential power to argue that presidents have absolute control of the executive branch, that the executive branch is under absolute control by the president. This theory is expanded and promoted, particularly under the George W. Bush administration, as it applies to things like the duties of commander-in-chief and the president's responsibility to protect the country. Now, clearly, presidents have a lot of authority over the executive branch. That is not in question. The question is, how much authority do they have? Are there limits to what the president can do in his capacity as the top person in the executive branch? Is the president above the law? Is the president above the law? Does the law apply to the president in discharging his constitutional authority? Now, it is very controversial in presidential scholarship and in legal scholarship to argue that. Although, you know, if we go back to Richard Nixon, that is essentially what Nixon argued in his famous interview with Frost, the British journalist, saying, look, if the president does it, it's not against the law.
Right.
And so
there's no such thing.
Right. And so that is essentially what – and I don't know why Alan Dershowitz would adhere to a very, very strong variant of the unitary – theory of the executive. I guess you'd have to ask him. Many people, other people, don't think the presidents are above the law, that they do have to obey the law when they are discharging their duties. And so the old saw, right, that the cover-up is worse than the crime may in fact apply here. I mean, we don't know if there was collusion between the Trump associates and the Russians, but there was enough there to warrant an investigation. And Trump's firing of Mr. Comey seemed to be motivated by, according to the president's own words, motivated by a desire to end that investigation. Hmm. So is the president in some legal trouble? Yes, I think the president is indeed in some legal trouble. In fact, if you look, he's retained counsel in this past week. Beyond the White House counsel, the White House counsel is investigating impeachment. The longtime Washington insider Brent Gergen, who was a member of the White House staff for Richard Nixon, a member of the White House staff for George Herbert Walker Bush, brought on by Bill Clinton to be an advisor while Bill Clinton was in the White House, has said, look, all of this looks like impeachment territory to me. Now, that man, longtime Washington insider, an insider in two administrations who did face impeachment, if he doesn't know what impeachment territory looks like, none of us do.
Mm. Of course, we're talking about the reality of Capitol Hill being in control of the Republican Party. So there are plenty of very smart observers who would say that, at least at this moment, any talk of impeachment is fanciful. that it's just not, it's maybe wishful thinking taken to an extreme, but that it's just not politically possible for that to in fact occur. What do you think about that?
I think it's politically improbable for it to occur. I think saying it's politically impossible is going too far. I mean, we don't know where things will head. We don't know how the landscape is going to shift. And it is plausible, right, that it reaches a point where Republicans feel that the rule of law is more important than their political partisan loyalties to the president. I don't think we're there yet by any stretch of the imagination. Will we get there? I have no idea. I don't really know. But you know, the articles of impeachment exist in the Constitution for a reason. And you know, abuse of power is one of them. Actually, Quinnipiac poll, University of Quinnipiac in Connecticut, came out with a poll a couple weeks ago. Do you think President Trump is abusing his powers? 54%. 54% of the country said yes. So, you know, does that mean the Republicans in the House of Representatives will see it that way? No, it doesn't mean that. But political pressure can be brought to bear.
Hmm. We have just a few minutes to talk beyond that about some matters of policy, and we just won't be able to explore that in any great detail. But maybe as kind of a segue, what does all of this that we've been talking about for the last few minutes, in a sense, do to the president's pursuit of his policy goals? I mean, the kind of the standard line is that this is all has to be a distraction somehow, or an impediment of one kind or another. Do you see it that way?
Yes, the institution of the presidency has expanded its powers over the course of the country's history. Presidents now are more powerful than they used to be. Why are they more powerful than they used to be? Well, the main mechanism by which modern presidents are more powerful than they used to be is that they have the capacity to reach out and build support amongst the public for them personally and for their agenda. They can use that support to push and persuade and build coalitions in the Congress to facilitate the passage of their agenda. They can use that capital, that political capital that comes in the form of public support to get the executive branch shifted in the direction they want it to. But if a president is mired in scandal, if his approval ratings are stuck in the 30s, the ability of the president to claim that he represents and what he wants represents the desires of the electorate of the American people is undercut. So, I mean, a president's effectiveness is not entirely, but it is to a degree a function of their popularity and approval amongst the public. So, you know, the inability of Trump to escape scandal makes it harder for him to push Congress in the direction that he wants them to go in terms of passing his budget, in terms of pushing for tax reform that he desires, for pushing for the health care policies that he wants, to get them to accept his priorities with respect to regulation and so forth.
In just a couple of minutes, I'm afraid, what are the points of policy with which you are most concerned, or where you take the most serious exception to his own policy?
Well, there's a lot of places to start. I mean, I could talk about health care. I could talk about infrastructure and so forth. I'm going to talk about environmental policy because that actually is my area of expertise. In 2013, MIT scientists published research in the journal Atmospheric Environment, in which they calculated the impact of air pollution on public health. And their estimate is that 200,000 persons die prematurely in the United States every year due to the effects of air pollution. 200,000 people die prematurely.
Wow.
That is primarily through the effects of air pollution on cardiac health. The respiratory system is affected, obviously, but so too is the circulatory system. Heart attack and heart attack and strokes lead to premature death. That goes up when air pollution is bad. Researchers in the journal Environmental Health Perspectives last year published research that links a premature birth with air pollution, particulate pollution in particular. They calculate that 3% of all premature births in the United States, that's somewhere around 16,000 premature births every year, are attributable to particulate pollution. Now, premature birth is associated with higher infant mortality. It's associated with cognitive impairment, developmental disabilities, and so forth, right? And they calculate that the human cost, the suffering, the misery that families go through when their babies are born with these kinds of problems. They calculate the economic cost of that to be $4 billion in 2010. That's just premature birth, right? So premature birth, premature death are just two dimensions of the overall detriment to public health that environmental pollution creates. And it is definitely in the public interest, right, that we have clean air to breathe, that we have clean water to breathe, that we are not exposed to toxins in the environment that are carcinogenic or will have serious impacts on our health. And the only way we can promote the public health is through the imposition, the implementation of effective regulation to limit the behavior of firms and companies that engage in those kinds of activities. In the absence of those rules, all of these problems get much, much, much worse. And so the stewardship of environmental protection under the Trump administration is far, very far outside the norm, right? Scott Pruitt is the director of the EPA. There is only one administrator in the EPA who is even close to the level of hostility he brings towards environmental protection. If you look at Republican administrators of the EPA, the very first one, William Ruckelshaus, widely liked across the spectrum, environmentalists respect him and so forth. William Riley was the widely respected administrator of the EPA for George Herbert Walker Bush. Christine Todd Whitman, Republican governor of New Jersey, she was the first administrator EPA for George W. Bush, widely liked and respected. All three of those persons, you know, were interested in protecting economic activity, trying to make sure that economic costs weren't higher than they needed to be. But all of them took seriously their obligation to protect the public health. Only Ann Gorsuch Burford, the first EPA administrator under President Reagan, brings to mind the level of hostility towards environmental protection that Scott Pruitt does. And so the actions that they've taken to roll back protections for such things as regulation on pesticides, regulation on fracking and energy development, they initiated the process to dismantle the Clean Power Plan. All of these things, very detrimental to the public interest.
And, of course, that's an interesting point in and of itself is this notion of is there a public interest, a common good that we have to be thinking about, or is it all about the individual and their own well-being? Complicated questions.
We all got to breathe. We all need water. Right? And to the extent that any of us does something to improve the quality of the air, to improve the safety of our water, we create benefits for everyone, right? The actions of an individual who works towards furthering a public good like clean air creates benefits that can't be excluded, right? That means there's a disincentive for individuals to invest in the care of that public good. economists call this the free rider problem. And the free rider problem means there will be insufficient investment in the creation and maintenance of public goods like clean air and clean water, right? If it's left to voluntary action, right, of individuals. It requires some kind of rule, right? The collective action. That is government regulation and legislation. That is mainstream economics. That is as mainstream as it gets. And that's why we have seen consistently presidents like George Herbert Walker Bush, even President Nixon, attentive to these kinds of issues in a way that President Trump and Scott Pruitt are definitely not.
And on that note, we need to leave this lively conversation, but I'm really glad we've been able to talk about as much as we have today. Dr. Jerry Mast, Associate Professor of Political Science at Carthage College. I'm really glad we had this conversation. I thank you. I look forward to your future visits to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg.
We will not